a couple of other well-known ones, some made by Palomar, and tried them in line, and then I used a directional coupler and put it in line to see if, you know, how much reduction it would make in any of the additional harmonics or any other things, noise that would come out of my amplifier. And what I noticed was the best band pass filter I could put in line with the antenna was an antenna tuner. And even when the tuning was just very, very slightly off 50 ohms, like just the difference of a dipole to 50 ohms, the amount of reduction in just about everything was reduced dramatically, much, much better than you'd see in even a standard band pass filter.
What you're reconfirming, Glenn, is that an antenna tuner, for the most part, is a PI filter, just like a tank circuit that used to be on our old tube type transmitters. It is a bandpass filter. And properly tuned, that bandpass filter has essentially only one resonant frequency. And even the second or third harmonic that might be there is not exactly harmonically related for a bunch of crazy reasons. So therefore, the real harmonics coming out of your transmitter, for the most part, will be nicely attenuated by your antenna tuner when the antenna tuner is properly set. Bear in mind that there are, in many cases, multiple ways of adjusting the antenna tuner, and the automatic function sometimes gets hung up on the wrong mode. You'll have a number of situations where guys will discover that when they switch from band, let's say 10 meters down to 40 meters in that order, where they're not using pre-assigned numbers on the antenna tuner, they're not working from its memory, they're letting its automatic function find the solution for your particular antenna. The possibility exists that when you flip from 10 meters down to 40 meters and you allow it to find the solution, it might get hung up. If you ask it to go from 10 meters down to 20 meters for a second first and then go to 40, it'll find the right solution. There's more than one way of adjusting a PI network to still resonate. Each one of those adjustments will have a higher or lower Q, but when you set it correctly, you'll have the ideal Q, which is usually around 10, and therefore a reasonable amount of harmonic rejection, and yet still reasonable circulating current within the inductors and capacitors of the tuner. There are ways you can reset the antenna tuner so that it runs at a higher Q, which means there's more circulating current, but it will simultaneously have a little bit more insertion loss, but a lot more rejection of the undesired frequencies. It pays your money, it takes your choice. So there are people who have an antenna tuner, and they insist on using it in the manual mode in order to get into the right ballpark before they let it slip over to the automatic mode, because the automatic mode will sometimes get hung up. What the automatic mode does, let me drop, it measures phase shift between input, output, and reflected signal, and looks for the right solution. The phase shift information, if it's properly interpreted, tells it which direction to go to come to the right solution. Well, measuring phase at RF frequencies in a strong RF environment can sometimes give you some errors, and the error can sometimes give you a crazy solution. Sometimes there's more than one solution, and the machine chooses the wrong one. So there's ways of getting used to your particular antenna tuner and forcing it to do what you want, even though it sometimes gives you a hang-up mode. It doesn't mean it's always failing. There's ways to get around that. And if you have any further questions or comments, give me a call, let us right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else? You've got it, Mel.
Okay. Now, when he was talking about that making the dipole, I remember this now. It just came to mind. Using a rota cable. I'll tell you what happened with that. We envision rota cable, which we use now, as a round cable, looks like a piece of coax cable with a number of wires in that sleeve. When the guy came up with the dipole using rota cable, he didn't use that type of rota cable. He used what you remember at the beginning, the rota cable was flat. It was a flat piece of cable that looked like a wider piece of the old 300 ohm twin lead. Or I should say like 450 ohm ladder line, but four wires, in other words, parallel to each other in that, flat jacket. It looked like at first glance, a wider piece of 300 ohm, if you remember how 300 ohm twin lead was was constructed. So what you did, you spread that thing out, you pulled it tight, you know, between 2 points, and then you just went and snipped it, you know, the 80-meter length, the full length, that was the end, had the insulators on both ends, and then you snipped back, and that is basically how that dipole came about using twin, using rotor cable, Dick. It was that twin lead looking rotor cable, if you remember, over.
I sure do. I still got some of that running up my tower, but it's got a nasty mode of failure. Eventually, in the ultraviolet exposure, the brown rubber ribbon cable, 4-leaded type, or the 6-leaded type rotor cable, dries out and starts cracking and losing its insulation, and eventually those wires will either touch the tower leg that it's taped to or start touching each other. So one of these days I'm going to remove that from my tower because I'm no longer using that particular ribbon cable to control that rotator, and I've got to do some repairs on that rotator. But even with that ribbon cable, which maybe was the original design for that particular inexpensive fan dipole, still those individual leads are really too close together to be a good fan dipole. You can make it work, but it takes a lot of fancy tuning to make it work. And I think that ribbon-type rotor cable may be no longer available. So that's a design that's become obsolete. If you're building a fan dipole, do it the more reasonable way with a few degrees of separation between each of the individual dipoles so the end insulators are not all in the same direction, if you know what I mean. Anybody have any further questions or comments? Give me a call with KQRIW.
Yeah, it was also, Dick, you know, it was very popular, that ribbon, as a for multi-band vertical, that you could cut it and use it as a radial. Also, it was very popular in those days for that use over.
Sounds good. So, I'm convinced that we've made nowhere near the proper amount of use of half-wave vertical radiators as opposed to quarter-wave. Quarter-wave ground plane antenna is a tough way to go. If you've got the resources to raise the radiator a little bit higher and make it electronically a half wave long, you're no longer dependent on putting down 32 ground plane radials to get the good efficiency. You get a higher center of radiation, get more gain on horizon, and it costs you very little extra money. In fact, it might even be cheaper. If I add just one more quarter wavelength of wire to the dipole to make it a half wave long, and I don't have to lay down 32 ground plane radials, I've come out way ahead in both dollars and man hours and performance. And other than that, it works good. But it's such an unpopular antenna. Everybody is positive that the half-wave dipole must be horizontal, parallel to the earth, fed in the center. And they think there's no other way to build a half-wave dipole. If you're smart enough to feed one end of a continuous piece of wire half-wave long, with no center insulator. As long as you're smart enough to feed one end, and you've got the right kind of impedance step-up device that feeds 1,000 ohms instead of 70 ohms, once you make that transition, and you mount that thing high enough, you'll get an awful lot of performance out of it. We've got to build more of those. Mel's been using one, and he thinks it's the best thing since baked bread. Best thing since a good brand of matzah, or whatever. Good stuff. Really works. And by the time he added that parabolic curve to his green wire and put it into his evergreen tree out in front of the house where it's giving him all this extra performance, someday we got to study that one, find out where all that extra performance is coming from. I think the majority of it is the fact that it's a half-wave dipole vertically mounted. I think he is feeding it in the center, but he could feed it at the bottom end if he wanted to. One of the things I did this week was to replace the coaxial cable that was on my UHF antenna that I use for digital television reception. Let me drop it. I'm a guy that insists on over-the-air reception. I'm the only guy in my town that's got an antenna on the roof. And I discovered that the antenna I installed 25 years ago is still in pretty good shape. I've tuned up my furnace to be efficient enough that it's not putting a whole lot of black soot on the antenna or in my chimney. The antenna itself looks nice and clean, and so I just replaced its 25-year-old RG6 transmission line. And so now I saw a little bit of improvement on channel 2. I'm getting twice as much signal strength on channel 2 but it's still a little bit flaky, and I think that's due to multipath. But many of the other channels that I was having trouble with are coming through much stronger. So, as I see it, the majority of people who have a rooftop-mounted antenna for UHF have not yet UHF/VHF have not yet realized that the transmission line can be in fairly poor shape and still give you pretty good channel 2 through 13 reception, lower VHF and upper VHF. But when you get to the UHF frequencies, the water that may be in the foam of the cable, the age of the cable, and whatever, makes a big difference. Now, that's with a UHF antenna mounted on the roof of my house, on the chimney, and I'm living on 300 feet above sea level land on Long Island, in a heavily treed environment, heavily treed community. When I eventually put a good UHF antenna at the 70-foot level of the tower and start doing some serious digital television DXing, I think the world will open up. I'll start seeing digital television from Rhode Island, Connecticut. Right now, I can watch Channel 50 from New Jersey quite nicely on a UHF antenna mounted on the chimney of the house. And I guess Channel 50 from New Jersey is probably about 40, 50 miles from me. And once that's up on the tower, and I can start getting multiple states and multiple channels, it should be kind of fun. So I for one, have not properly serviced my UHF television antenna in a lot of years. And so an awful lot of people are reluctant to do that. They just go over to cable. And they pay $130 a month. They're getting more channels. That's the good news. But they're paying $1,000, $1,500 a year. And these are tough times economically. And how those people justify that among many other hidden expenses, like paying 28% on the interest rate for their credit card, how people tolerate that. Here, repeater, timeout. How people tolerate these huge expenses year after year without thinking about it is a bit amazing to me. I think their philosophy is, well, I've always done it this way. All my friends are doing it this way. Why should I do it any differently? Well, if you like spending your money that way, it's your choice. Anybody have any further questions or comments? Give me your call letters right now. And if not, let's wait long enough for the people in far-off areas to sign in. K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2SCO.
N2, either SCL or SCO, Sierra Charlie Lima, and I'm going to make a guess. Start with your name and correct me on your call letter, sir. I'm K2RIW, and my name is Dick.
Hey, Dick, K2RIW. This is November 2, Sierra Charlie Lima. You are correct. The name is Gary. And I was just scanning around, and I heard you ask for calls, so I figured I'd check in.
Very good, Gary. You're listening to Technical Net on Limelock, number 1250. I wonder if you have to have any questions or comments about ham radio or digital television. These are the usual subjects we discuss quite often on Sunday nights. Over to you, Gary.
The only thing I can ask is right now I have a magnet mount antenna on the roof of the car for 2 meters. It's actually a 6-meter/2-meter antenna, and I just realized that basically that it's been giving me a lot of trouble, and I'm not really sure why. I've been having a hard time pinpointing it, but I was thinking of just, it was a cheap MFJ antenna, and I was just thinking of biting the bullet and buying a decent quality antenna, but I'm really not sure what to go after. Any thoughts?
Yes, Gary. I've been using mag mounts on my car for 20 years, and every 5 years or so, I have to replace the cable because where I snake the cable in between the rubber, where the I got a 4-door sedan, where the rear door slams, the rubber is being pressed against the feed line and bending it into a crazy shape. And each time that particular door gets open, the rubber gets bent, the feed line gets bent and unbent, and eventually gives me a fatigue failure. So every few years, I've got to replace that feed line. Otherwise, the antenna becomes an almost open circuit. In the case of the feed line that I replaced on my digital television, I recognize that it's got a pickup folded dipole-like mechanism, which represents a direct DC short. And so once I hooked up the 40 feet of cable, brought it into the house, I set my ohm meter between the semiconductor and the outer coax braid of the F connector. I measured something like 3 ohms. Because of the gauge of the wire and 40 feet of it, that's approximately right. It should be 3 ohms. Therefore, I knew I was making good contact all the way up to the UHF television aerial on the chimney of the house. By the same token, most likely your mag mount represents a short circuit at the antenna end, or even if it doesn't, you can put your ohm meter between the semiconductor and the radiator and measure whether or not it's got the right number of ohms as you wiggle that feed line. And I think there's a 50-50 chance you had a failure of that feed line that you confirm with your ohm meter, and replacing the feed line is an easy thing to do. So you've got the choice of either buying a brand new antenna and spending some money, or fixing the one you got. There's a reason it went bad, and you're smart enough to find out what that reason is and decide if that's what you want to do. That's just a possible suggestion, Gary. And two, STL, and I think you're mobile. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm mobile. I just got on the parkway heading north, exit 105 in East Town. It's an intermittent problem, and I've been having a hard time pinpointing it. I'm pretty sure it's not the radio, because the receiver and the transmitter are affected, so it's a bad connection. But I've been having trouble, like, figuring out what it is. As a matter of fact, I don't know if I have it fixed right now, but right now I am working, so that's why I was getting frustrated. I figured I would just maybe buy something else. But I guess I can keep playing. Maybe I'll take out an ohm meter tomorrow and do what you said. Because I really would rather fix it. Because there's no reason why, if it's operating properly, it works well enough.
Yeah, I recommend you do that. And while you've got the ohm meter connected with clip reads, take the portion of the coax cable where it goes past the door and is being bent by the door. Wiggle the cable, bend it a little bit, whatever. Wiggle it at the end of the antenna. Wiggle it at the end where the connector is that goes into the rig. So by wiggling the cable, whenever I get a failure of that cable, it is an intermittent failure. And it only shows up on an ohm meter when I bend the cable. So that intermittent failure, it fits all of the characteristics, and I think that's repairable most of the time, Gary. Good luck with that project. And whether it works or doesn't work, come back and tell us about it. N2SCL for any other comments, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, I appreciate the help there and the advice. And I'll give it back over to you guys. I'll just stay on the side and see what I can learn from the net. Thank you very much, and we'll be listening. N2SCL.
Okay, do we have anyone else with any questions or comments? And if not, let the machine drop for a few seconds. Let's see if anyone out of area wants to sign in. KQRIW in the TechNet listening.
WB2CUK with something a little different to ask you, Dick.
Bill recognized. Let's see if there's anyone else.
WA2VDH, Andrews John.
There's a guy who signs in the right way, John. Very funny. John recognized. Anyone else? I want to let the machine drop for enough seconds because the guy's out of area. Need that extra time. Hey, Bill, the guy who runs the swapping shop, what kind of equipment can I be getting for the right price these days with your swapping shop? That's a lightly settled question. Bill, what would you like to talk about tonight? You got it. K2RIW.
Okay, good evening, Dick, and welcome, everybody. As you know, there's a little golf, little tournament going on here in Farmingdale at the golf course, and I've noticed that the MetLife blimp has been hovering, and over my house, from my house, I have eyesight of the blimp. What I would like to know is, this is a ham radio-related question, what frequency do they use to transmit the pictures of the golf course from that blimp? I'm sure it's digital. I'm sure it's some kind of digital, maybe X-band radar range and so on. I'm just kind of curious if you know, and Dick, if you don't know, where I can find it on the web, because I got my computer on, and I'd like to do a search and maybe tune into the pictures coming from that blimp. if it's at all possible. Well, what are your thoughts on this? WB2C, you guess.
I am guessing the frequencies they're using are relatively similar to the frequencies that are used by the electronic news gathering trucks. And the guy who has worked in that industry for a number of years is Bill, WB2QGZ, Whiskey Bravo 2, Quebec Golf Zulu. And he would be able to tell you the frequencies. I believe it's in the vicinity of 2 or 3 gigahertz. In that vicinity, not X-band. And in the old days, it used to be analog television that was being transmitted on those studio to remote links. And I'm not sure you would gain a lot being able to receive that frequency, because most likely it is now digital, just like you said. And most likely you're not going to see anything substantially different than when you watch Channel 4, which is what you've been watching. WNBC has been transmitting during Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Those golf games are quite a bit, continuously. So yes, it would be a fun experiment if you were a microwave ham radio operator to listen to the direct broadcast. Drag your feet a little bit just in case Bill is listening. He might chime in and tell us what he knows on the subject. WB2CUK to take it with a little bit of delay. KQLIW in the TechNet. Looks like Bill might not be there tonight. You got it. That's Bill number 2, QGZ. Bill number 1, CUK, you got it.
Okay, Dick, very good. Well, I was just thinking that. And it's funny, you know, when you get older, your brain cells are a little slow to react. And I've seen this blimp since Friday, or Thursday or Friday, when they started the contest. And it just dawned on me to ask that question. I should have answered a little bit earlier, and maybe even popped on a scanner. As a listener, I have a number of scanners in the house here. I probably could have just searched the man's well enough and would have at least heard the air traffic control for it or something like that. But tomorrow's the last day, probably, and what can I tell you? But it's been hectic here in the village. They close a lot of streets and restricted parking to residents. So it's been a lot of fun. And yes, I have been watching it and seeing how frustrated they get on getting birdies and 10-foot putts. Now I know why I never took up golf, because it's too frustrating. Dick, back to you in the net, and thanks for the information. Maybe Bill will be on the repeater tomorrow or something, and maybe I can tune something in. I kind of doubt it, though. If you say it's digital, it's probably encoded in a way that you couldn't receive anyway. So back to you, Dick, and I'll just be listening. WBQ, see you guys.
KC2QAQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I have a little chart up here. Does he know what channel or what network is actually carrying it? Because it can be anywhere between, say, like 5 to 30 gigahertz, depending on the TV network that's actually doing the satellite link.
Since it was WNBC, Channel 4, that was transmitting it over the air continuously, most likely it was NBC doing that work. So what studio to remote links does NBC use? Glenn, go ahead.
Their frequency doesn't give an exact, it's just kind of a bar chart, but it should be somewhere like around 12 to 13 gigahertz, somewhere in that area.
I'm amazed, because those are the frequencies also used for the downlink of direct TV transmission. But it makes sense. You get some nice aiming of the antenna back to the studio with that. Bill, you being a golf watcher, and you're not frustrated by actually playing the game, I know that there's a playoff going to take place tomorrow between Tiger Woods and another guy. Tiger is fighting for what position? I think it's not first place. Is he fighting for the 13th position, if you happen to know? Over to you, Bill.
Yeah, he's pretty far down there. I forget the three guys that are up top. One guy was eight below par. Another guy was 7. I think Mickelson is up there, number 3. And Tiger is all the way down there. I watched him in the beginning, and he just he wasn't getting his groove. He was missing putts that he should have made. A lot of the other guys were making the putts, and he just didn't get enough holes there to come in. So he's going to have a lot of work cut out for tomorrow. I think he's about 13.
So in other words, the playoff between him and one other player is to clearly define who is number 13 and who is number 14. Is that approximately what it is, Bill?
I don't know if they have a playoff. I think they just keep playing until the last hole. I would imagine the 18th hole, whoever's on top gets to play. I guess the final two guys. Whoever that I don't think I think that's November of last year. Last time I watched it, I tell you the last the top two guys play, and the rest of them are just out of it.
Yeah, what I heard is that Tiger Woods and the other guy who has the same score that he tied with must play 18 holes tomorrow, and who has the best score after that 18 holes will occupy that particular position. Maybe 13 and 14. I think, no. Do all of the players have one more round to go, or is the tournament essentially over? I don't remember them announcing who the number one runner is. They only told you what the current standings are. So I think there's at least one more round to have to make up because of all the rain cancellations. But there's at least one more day for almost everybody. Is that true, Bill?
Go ahead. Yeah, they started around 4 this evening. I was away from the TV from about 5 o'clock on, so I didn't get to see them start. Yeah, I think they just start the next round, and whoever comes out on top comes out on top. I didn't hear anything about a playoff. If two guys have to play 18 holes, that would take a couple of hours, and then you stretch it to Tuesday. So I don't know. You know, I didn't really watch all the details, but I'll be watching tomorrow early in the morning when it starts, because there's not much else on TV, and it has been a distraction. It's kind of interesting to watch these guys and all the people that are out there. I couldn't even get near the course. They got it blocked off very thoroughly, the course.
Now, the course is actually in Farmingdale. Correction, in Bethpage. I used to caddy on that course way back in the dark ages in Bethpage. Both the black, the green, the red, and the blue were the colors of the courses in those days. I think they've added white and yellow since. And that black was a tough one. In fact, it's a great big warning sign you've probably seen on television a few times, that the black is a tough course. And not only is it tough, but I think it goes to some pretty high altitudes. I know a significant number of people have been struck by lightning while playing golf on the black course. And it happens a lot more frequently than any of the other courses at Bethpage. Now, Bethpage is the next town north of Farmingdale. I think you live in Farmingdale, my hometown. So you're telling me even the adjacent town is blocked off for traffic and parking and so on. Is that what you're telling me, Bill? At the BTC UK, K2RIW?
Well, all the streets adjacent to the course, around Swamp Road, which actually goes between, that's on one edge of the black, and I think it's Winding Hill Road. That's the road that goes past the Fireman's Training Center. I think that's blocked off. And you can get near there, but I think you can come down Merritt Road. You can go down Central Avenue, I think, to Bethpage. But right where it's adjacent to the any road that goes adjacent to the course, you're not going to get to see. And I didn't know exactly where this course was in relation to all these roads, and I looked on a map, and then I saw you can't even see the course from the highway. It's really buried behind all those trees, and that's where they're doing it. But, yeah, and then the town put up signs, no parking on the streets for a week, you know, during the course, and they sent out these parking stickers to put on the car, the things to hang in inside your car. So, yeah. That's just in Farmingdale. I don't know if they're doing the best page or not, but it's interesting, and it should be interesting to watch it tomorrow and see who wins it all. And the rain has really been something with that, all those the puddles there and everything. And as they showed the rain there, it was raining here, so I'm no more than 2 miles from it, Dick.
And WS2N checking in.
The US2N recognized, and I'm going to want to hear about the Orion, as you'll hear. Let me pick up one more person. We've got a question. That was John. WA2 Victor Delta Hotel, if I got it right, John. Go right ahead with your question. My name is Dick.
Okay, fine. Fine business, Dick. Yeah, the handle is John. You had the call correct, WA2VDH. My question has to do with antenna matching. I know that in your article you mentioned that you see a resistance in series with the reactants, and then throwing a capacitance across, they will of course match. But aren't you interested in seeing a parallel combination of some parallel resistance in parallel with some inductive reactance, which is going to be different than, of course, than the series question? That's my first question. My other question has to do with DTV, but I'll turn it back to you, Dick.
Good question, John. And I sort of handle that left-handedly in the article by saying there's interaction. When you use conventional impedance measuring hardware, like a vector network analyzer, like an RX bridge, they tend to give you the equivalent series resistance and equivalent series reactance. For every R and X that are in series with each other, at that exact frequency, there is a parallel combination that will act the same. In other words, if I'm not changing the frequency, and I've got, I'm going to pick numbers out of the air, 75 ohms resistance in series with 10 ohms of reactance, inductive reactance. That's the real network, and I put that into black box number one. If I'm smart enough, I can make a parallel R and X, and I put it in black box number two, and at that frequency, they will act the same. There's an exact duality of series and parallel. In fact, all you've got to do on a Hewlett-Packard modern-day calculator, which has complex mathematics into it, you put the R and X into parentheses with a comma in between the two. That means the machine knows it's in the series mode. You simply press 1 over X key on the front panel, and it will give you the parallel equivalent right on the screen in a fraction of a second. And you can put that into black box number two, and you would not be able to measure the difference until you sweep the frequency. The equivalent circuit will act a little bit differently when you sweep frequency. So, what I'm getting at is that after you've made the measurement, if you happen to know your antenna has a certain amount of resistance and a certain amount of reactance, and you corrected the resistive component by readjusting the length of the dipole, like I recommend. Let me drop. And you end up with, let me say, 10 ohms of inductive reactance. And if you could put a 10 ohm resistor in series with the antenna feed line, in one step you would get a perfect match. However, putting a capacitor in series or inductor in series with the center of a dipole is mechanically difficult to do. Simply putting a shunt capacitor across the two leads, the feed point of the dipole, does the same thing, but you're absolutely right. It creates interaction. When I put a capacitor across the feed terminal, I am correcting the reactive component in the right direction, but it requires a slightly different amount of shunt capacitance to do it, and it does cause a readjustment of the resistance. That's the reason why I say there's interaction. But since you have complete control of the resistive component by making the dipole longer and shorter, you will, in a two or three step iterative process, you will find the solution by putting the capacitor in parallel. And you're putting it in parallel because it's so easy to do mechanically. But if you've got the resources to do it in series, you will get it in one step as opposed to three steps. So that's the trade-off there as I see it, John. WA2VDH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine. This is Vic. Yeah, I guess that's also why the stub matching, they work them in admittance, because that automatically is giving you a parallel combination. Yeah, I can understand it's difficult doing an element in series with coaxial cable, just not mechanically viable. My other question has to do with DTV. Maybe I should just pause first and turn it back to you and see if there's any other comments. Come back to you, Vic.
Oh, you've got it. You've got it right on target, John. Go ahead with your digital TV question.
Okay, fine. Business. Yeah, my question on DTV. I don't know if this has been covered in the past, but it has to do with digital rights management. Do these converter boxes pass on? Any of the, I think it's CGMS or CGSM signals that allow you to tape once or make a DVD copy once or not copy at all. Do they pass that on in the vertical interval? I haven't had a chance to look in the vertical interval of coming out of the converter box, I have to see what's going on there. I do have a scope on my DCR that I'm doing DCR to DVD transfers, and I watch the vertical interval to see what's going on some of the tapes. And I know that the Disney tapes. Let's drop. I know the Disney tapes put a lot of the anti-copy signals in there, but I'm just wondering what happens with the converter boxes and how they handle the digital rights management. Go ahead.
Don, good question. I don't know. Now, if Eric is available, KE2EJ, who is our broadcast engineer, there's a good chance he knows the answer to that. And even if there is digital information put in the vertical interval, first of all, I know that you have the ability to take the digital converter box and use the composite video and audio, in other words, left, right, and video, and you can feed them into the auxiliary ports of your display device, television. So there's ways you can put that into a recording device, and as well as coming out with Channel 3, which is analog modulated. And even if that digital signal is there to stop you from copying it, there are crafty amateurs out there who will find a way of building a circuit that becomes active during the vertical interval and changes that signal in some way so that recording can still take place. In the past, there are all kinds of ways that people found to get around the copyright signal so that they were able to make a copy for themselves. Thank goodness these guys were not making the copies and then selling a zillion of them and trying to make a whole lot of money on it, because the law will come down on you when you do that. But if you're doing it for your own purpose and you build a circuit that allows you to make a recording, I don't think there's any strict rules about that. So even if it exists, there's ways of foxing it, I'm reasonably sure. But I don't know right now if it exists. If I had to make a guess, I would guess it does, because an awful lot of the material produced by many of the networks is considered... Hold on. Many of us are using a TiVo-like machine, which allows you to make a recording and play it back later. Maybe there isn't. Or maybe there's something unique about TiVo. I wonder if anyone on frequency knows anything more about that. Can I take the output of my digital box and put it into whatever recording device I've got? Old-fashioned video cassette recorder, modern DVD recorder, whatever. If you've got knowledge on this subject, please give us your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
WS2N.
Paul recognized. Anyone else?
KC2QIQ.
Glenn recognized. Anyone else? Okay, we're going to get two good answers. Paul first. You got it, Paul.
Okay, Dick.
And Glenn, Doug recognized too.
My cable box, no problem. I'm doing that for years. And I'm doing the same thing as what he just mentioned. I make a lot of recording from the tapes to the disc. Of course, Disney I can't do. But as far as coming through the either my regular digital box, cable vision, no, 100% legally. In fact, they give you any kind of cables you want to do it. I don't have a DVR here, which is essentially a hard drive that they'll give you or rent to you per month. I have a DVD / VCR recorder, and never had a problem recording. I record everything there because I just do commercials. Let me drop it. Also, coming through without the box, I have a AB switch on that, so I could pick up what's coming through the cable dry, with nothing to do with the cable box. I do that because I want to maybe record something, and I want to watch something else. So not only is it legal, they gave me the AB the switch, the nice AB switch that handles all the way up to the whatever frequencies that they come through. It's better than what you can buy in the stores. The ones that you buy in the stores, I think only go up to 900 meg or something. These go beyond that, whatever it is. And they hand it to you. Here's all your cables, here's your AB switch, no problem with that. Corpus. Just recently picked up an HDTV, joined that group, and went over to the cable without the box, you know, switched over to just the cable coming through the wall, and ran through a scan, similar to what you would do if you were going to scan the airwaves, and where I used to get 35 stations, I think I come up with 67 or something like that, 67 stations, and every one of them comes in through perfect. In fact, it's many of them, 2, 4, 5, 7, they'll come up with these 2.2 numbers, 4.2 numbers, whatever, and those are high definition pictures, and it comes through high definition on my HD TV. I can record them. I can record that. There's not one station has ever I've ever had a problem with where I couldn't do it. So my guess now, I just tonight I'm a little late because I bought a converter. Let me drop it. I bought a converter. I'm on a backup. If I lose cable, this way I'll have a backup. Let me see what I get. So I put it on one of my old TVs in one of the rooms, just with rabbit ears, and I'm able to pick up a few stations, 55, which is a local, that's Long Island, which is what I really wanted to do, and a couple of the other ones, 13, which is actually 13 HD, that was an HD TV in that little room. I'd be able to even watch that in high definition. So I think I got five stations coming through, 13, 55, and a couple of 13 stations there that come through, a couple of Spanish stations. But the main one I wanted to get was 55. I haven't gotten around to putting an outdoor antenna. I bet thousands of dollars, I haven't done it yet, I can record off of that. There's probably no problem with that. I haven't tried that yet, but my guess is there should be no problem there. Back to you, WS1.
Very fine, Bill. Thank you for your experience. We're going to go to Glenn and Doug in that order. And the more I think about it, I guess I'm beginning to think now that maybe there isn't very much of a vertical interval signal in there, because in the past there were recording devices that would put that signal in there so that you couldn't make a video cassette recording of a video cassette tape in the old days. And there were quite a few television sets who had trouble reproducing that signal. And life got very complicated. So a person building a box nowadays that's supposed to do a conversion into an old-fashioned analog set would worry about whether or not the set will perform correctly. So if they do have a anti-theft signal in there, it's got to be something that doesn't have very much of an effect on ordinary television reception. Otherwise, there's going to be a lot of unhappy people. Let's see what Glenn's got to say about this. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, most of the signals that are available to you over either your Cablevision, Fios, the satellite TV, or even direct over-air broadcast in your digital format and analog in the past, you're limited to what the outputs of the box that you have are. In other words, and the components that you can record are component, composite, S-video, VHF output. Those are your typical outputs from those boxes that will allow you to make an analog recording of the digital signals that are coming in. There is another interface called an HDMI interface. That's the high-definition multimedia interface. That one does have some copy protection on it. That is one that really makes it a little bit more difficult. Not impossible to copy, but it's got some copy protection signals built into that interface that doesn't allow you to record on most of your standard copying devices. Now, also, there's another possibility that can be done, too. Some of the boxes, not too many that I've seen, have something called a DVI interface. Now, the DVI is a digital direct output interface, but none of the boxes that I've seen so far have it. Doesn't mean that there isn't one out there that does, I just haven't seen it yet. If it does, there's no copy protection on that digital interface. That's mainly seen on computers, where you can find that interface. And there again, if you can network the box to your computer, if you have an active network inside your house, and you can address the box, you can also, there's a way that you can also download digital information direct from there. But basically, if you just want to connect a recorder of some type up to the box, you're pretty much limited to the analog signals. Component, composite, S-video, and VHF out. KC2QIQ.
Thank you for all that information, Glenn. Wow. HDMI, DVI. What a bunch of connectors we've got. looks like nobody can really settle on a standard. And I'm not convinced that any of these connectors are carrying frequencies that are so high and data rates that are so fast that to don many different connectors are required, different interconnection techniques. I guess some of what's going on here is to be reverse compatible as well as being forward compatible. Glenn, do you think that we're all eventually going to settle down to one or two kinds of interface connectors, or are we always going to be keeping all of these zillions of standards? Back to you, Glenn.
WB2BXO with a question about HDMI.
BXO, and you're going to be after Doug, but Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
I think one of the problems that's always biting us with television and broadcast and everything is that there's so many different forms of media out there. There are people who still have VCRs. There's people with DVD players. Now there's Blu-ray. And what's happening is the manufacturers are trying to always be downward compatible as best as they can so that they can support as many of the systems, because people are always going to want to be able to use their media. They don't want to throw away all their VHS tapes, you know, and then people get DVDs. And now Blu-ray's out. And so the connectors eventually, I think, will somewhat, but we're going to have to wait to a point to where the technology starts to flatten out a little bit. Right now, HDTV to the consumer is very brand new. So I'd imagine you're going to see consumer products with a lot of different connectors for quite some time until eventually it becomes like VHF television was, where you just hook the box up to a single connector. I think we'll eventually get there, but I think it's quite a few years down the road, Dick. KC2, QIQ.
Well, is he right? WS1, 100% right.
Glad to hear that, Glenn and Paul. Okay, Doug's the next person who wanted to make a question or a comment. So the A2SAY. Go right ahead, Doug.
WA2SAY, back to the net. Two comments, neither of them really technical. The first one is that I think it has been decided by the court that you can copy anything for your own use, and that's called fair use. So if you can figure out a way to do it, you can do it. If you can use it, it's not illegal, you can't get arrested for it. It's, you know, if you want to make a copy of a CD and play it in your car, for example, so that you don't ruin the original CD, that's fair use. My other comment has got nothing to do with ham radio directly, but I wanted to pass it on to the network. On Sunday, this coming Sunday, from 9 to 3, there will be a computer show at the Marriott Hotel, which is near to exit 57 on the Long Island Expressway. I don't know if it's 57, 58, whatever it is exactly. On the north side of the expressway, the Marriott Hotel, 9 to 3, a computer show. So that's over to the net from WA2SAY.
Now, I think you said that that's next Sunday, which I think means that it's the same weekend as a field day. That's the Sunday coming. Let's see, now this is the 21. Is that going to be June 28th, to your knowledge, Doug? Go ahead.
As far as I know, that's correct.
And how did you find out about this one? Where was it advertised, Doug? Go ahead.
I really don't know. My son called me up and told me about it.
Okay.
What a comment.
Go ahead, Joe.
I believe those computer shows around Long Island are run by Market Pro. If you look at marketpro.com, you should be able, I believe that's the correct address, you should be able to look up their website. They use a listing of our shows and then dates throughout the whole area as far as what it is. Cause they used to be up in the store up in Lake Grove, the Sports Plus, and since that closed down, I guess they moved elsewhere, but that's probably who's doing it. I believe it's marketpro.com.
Good to know. Thank you very much. Okay, the next person who signed in with question or comment, I think it was Paul. And first of all, before I turn it over to Paul, is there anyone else that I've missed? Okay, apparently not. Paul, you may have questions or comments on all of the above, and if not, you can begin your space report. But let me tell you one thing that's, first of all, there was a launch this week that you're going to be telling us about, which went to the moon. McNeil Lehr Report. I guess it's called Lehr Report these days. Nightly News or something like that. Evening News, Nightly News. You know the one that's on PBS. I think it was Wednesday. They had a section that went on for about 10 to 15 minutes, talking about the Orion program of NASA, where a number of NASA engineers have anonymously joined a group which are protesting the Orion design, saying that it's not optimum, that they know of ways of making it better, but NASA is committed to the current, to follow through with the current Orion design. They're already starting to build prototypes. That was on this nightly news on TBS with McNeil or with Lair, and they give you a website by which you can go and play back their previous news reports. For reasons I don't understand, they've eliminated that whole section from what you can play back. It's no longer available. Is that because it's controversial? Obviously it's controversial when you have a bunch of engineers thinking that the design that we're committed to is not the right design. You might have some information on that one, Paul. WS2F, our space expert, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, wait a minute, one second. WB2BXO signed it, Dick.
Ah, yes, Frank. I knew I forgot somebody. Frank, sorry about that. Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, no big deal. It was in the other room anyway. And Mel, good to hear you. I'll try to catch up with you before the end of the evening and get an update on what's happening with our local field day. If not, I'll talk to you Tuesday probably. And my question essentially was about with reference to HDMI, as both my wife and my dad benefit from closed caption, and I'm at some point going to get an HD set, large HD set as our main TV at our house in Pennsylvania. And one suggestion that was made to me was not to connect it with HDMI cables, because in some cases there was an issue with closed captioning being transferred. I was wondering if that's the case, and if so, whether that issue exists over the air or with cable box, with some of the cable TV services, or both, if it's true at all. Another unrelated issue, if you want to deal with it another time, that's fine. I haven't checked tonight, but I noticed last week I could not get the TechNet feed on the internet through the W2LIE monitoring site. I was wondering if anybody knew if that had been fixed. I haven't checked tonight, though, since obviously I'm here in Brooklyn and I'm working out over the air. That's different, of course, from my IRLP. That's listening only in more or less real time. Go ahead, Dick. WB2BXO.
Now, I'm getting digital over-the-air broadcast by way of a Radio Shack digital converter box, and on almost every one of the channels that I'm able to watch, I can dial in closed caption, and it gets printed across the screen of a analog television connected to the digital converter box. So it would appear to me that getting closed caption is relatively easy, and I can choose what language I get it in also. I'd be kind of amazed that if HDMI over the air or through cable would for some reason restrict closed caption. That certainly would be showing discrimination to people who are handicapped in some way. Glenn, I wonder if you have any knowledge on this one. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Press Glenn comment.
Okay, Paul, go right ahead with your comment. Maybe Glenn's not there now.
KC2QIQ, I'm back, but I'll wait.
Okay, Glenn first and then Paul in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
On the HDMI, it's just an output, very similar to any of the other outputs that you'd have from a control box. Now, how you set up your box is the filter. So if you turn off closed captioning and you try to create closed captioning off of the recording, it won't be there because it was filtered out from the box. If you turn on closed captioning so that it's basically printing out, that signal will go down the HDMI. But there again, there's no, there is a way to record HDMI signals, but they still should go down to the TV set, so it's really the settings. Now, if you do copy if you turn off the filtering and you allow it to run through, you have to make sure that whatever the playback device is has the same capabilities as your television set in order to receive it. Does that make any sense, KC2QIQ?
Okay, good, yeah. Okay, I'm glad Eric signed it. Hey, Eric, we got a number of questions on copyright of material over the broadcast reception, and the same thing with closed caption. KE2EJ, KQRW, you got it, Glenn. I mean, Eric.
Yeah, I think you're going to have to run the questions by me, but as far as closed captioning goes, it's actually two different forms. One is CCIR 708 and 608. One is actually in the analog video that you could be sending to your TV set. So if your TV set has a closed caption decoder on it, it actually decodes field 2 of line 21, which many of the DVD boxes generate. And the other type of closed caption is EIA 708. That's actually in the data stream. So there's two different kinds of things. And because many of the source materials come from traditional analog stuff, the encoders that they use will actually take the 608 captions and turn them into 708 captions and transmit both of them. As far as HDMI goes, that's a digital signal that actually sends luminous and Y minus Y and B minus Y down the cable. And I see there's HDMI 1, HDMI 2, and they do it as digits. And if your recording device is an analog thing, you're generally not plugging into it via HDMI. So, getting closed caption is not an issue either way, because it comes down to pipes. It's a matter of what you do with it and which kind it is and where you're taking it from. So, throw me your other questions. K2RW, K2J.
That was Frank who asked this question because he has members of his family that consider the closed caption kind of valuable. I wonder if your question was answered, Frank, or if you want to ask another one. WB2BXO, K2RIW.
And a closed caption comment, WS1.
Okay, but Frank first. Go ahead, Frank.
Okay, very good. I wasn't really talking about it so much in the context of recording, though that is a good point. What I'm hearing is to make sure if there is a problem with captioning, either using HDMI cables or component cables or recording or whatever, make sure closed captioning is turned on at the cable box. Or the converter box, depending on how I'm bringing the signal in, and not just on the television, because most of us are accustomed to turning closed captioning on at the television. Interesting issue we ran into this weekend is my wife wanted to watch, missed an episode of Royal Pains, and wanted to watch it on demand. And when she got it from Comcast on demand, it didn't seem to be carrying the closed captioning. And we were wondering who to ask about that, Comcast or the program provider. Eric, I don't, at the risk of putting you on the spot, you may know the answer to that one. With Dick's permission, go ahead.
You got it, Eric. Guys, when you're doing on-demand, you're actually playing a file out of your server. Depending upon how it got put into the server, a couple of things can happen. But generally, if you're coming out of a cable box, and it depends on how you're hooking up to your monitor, some cable boxes will actually do the closed captioning for you and stick in the video. There are other boxes that if you're taking components but not HDMI, it'll come down the video cable. But in any event, the if you're talking cable, I don't know too many cable boxes, but I believe you have the option to turn the closed captioning on and off, and if you want to see it, you're going to have to turn it on. With the digital tuners that you use with your analog sets, it actually generates the closed captions inside the box, not relying on the monitor to display to make the